This podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and does not constitute formal medical advice, clinical guidance, or institutional policy. The views expressed are those of the hosts and guests and may not reflect those of any official policies or affiliated organizations. Always verify information, consult appropriate resources, and apply your own clinical judgment before caring for patients. Welcome to Gray Matters, where we unpack how medical management is rarely black or white
and go on deep dives along the way.
I'm Dr. Nick Villano.
And I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi.
So Shreya, it's been a while. I'm looking forward to jumping back into the fog of uncertainty with you.
The fog of uncertainty. Sounds really dreadful, but I do think it's easier to cut through fog with some help and some friends.
So I had this patient on the inpatient wards recently. He's 72. He has a history of hypertension and diabetes, and he comes in with syncope. Turns out he had severe urinary retention. I mean, they placed a catheter in the ED and over a liter of urine came out.
A liter? Gosh, that makes me so uncomfortable to even think about.
I know, it's one of those things you can just feel. But to figure out why he had severe urinary retention, you know, we got an MRI that showed that his prostate wasn't too big and there was no cord compression. But eventually we did find out that his hemoglobin A1C was 12.5%. So we start insulin.
I'm still thinking about that urinary retention. I bet he had a pretty gnarly AKI from that.
But thankfully, the AKI did resolve with the catheter. He did have some post-obstructive diuresis. You know, he got a little lightheaded since he was peeing a ton, but we gave him fluids and eventually his polyuria resolved.
What happened next?
So here's the thing. His polyuria resolved, but his lightheadedness did not resolve. I had been giving him a lot of fluids. He had been net positive for a few days now. You know, like I said, his sugars were looking better. So I was like, there's no way this patient can still be dehydrated. And then I realized I'm facing my old nemesis.
Oh no, don't say it. The biggest discharge blocker of them all.
Afraid so. Orthostatic hypotension.
Yeah. Sympathy. Though I will say, Nick, I'm glad we're talking about this because I feel like our patients are so complex in the hospital and often slips my radar until I got a message from a nurse like the day before discharge saying, oh, this patient almost, you know, passed out when they stood up, or their blood pressure was this when they stood up.
Yeah. I mean, if it's not on the problem list, we sometimes forget about it, but it's surprisingly common. I found that 1 in 5 patients over the age of 60 actually deal with orthostatic hypotension. And some studies actually documented it in half of nursing home residents.
It's humbling to even think that, but we might even catch more people if we actually diagnosed it correctly. So why don't we start there?
Yes, that is exactly where I want to take us for our first deep dive, because I learned that it's a lot more than just having someone stand up and check their blood pressure.
Let's be honest, between the back-to-back patients, inbox overload, and real life, our schedules can be a bit of a mess, and that's why we're a fan of Oakstone CME's programs, including their ACP MixApp Audio Companion, as well as their Board Prep. It's CME designed for how we actually live and work. You get audio, video, text-based formats, all easy access through either a mobile app or the desktop. You can throw on a MixApp episode while walking to work or prepping for dinner, and it's just really satisfying to check off a topic while multitasking. The platform is pretty intuitive, streamlined, no fuss. Whether you've got 10 minutes or an hour, you can jump in, make progress, and move on with your day. Honestly, it's become one of my favorite ways to keep learning without carving out quote-unquote study time. So if you've got a commute time, gym time, or just some downtime, you've got some CME time. Check out oakstone.com/mixapp. That's oakstone/MKSAP. Use the code CORE25 for 25% off, and this is exclusive to CoreAM listeners, so don't forget to use the code CORE25. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Okay, I think we've all learned that orthostatic hypotension is a consequence of changing position, right? We stand up, blood pools in the leg and the gut, and so venous return drops, and so does our cardiac output. And then normally, our nervous system detects that and ramps up our sympathetic tone, and we're fine. We just go about our day. But if our nervous system or our heart can't respond normally, then the blood pressure stays low, our cerebral perfusion drops, and then we pass out or just feel awful. And we're looking for that drop in the blood pressure when standing to make the diagnosis.
Exactly. And more precisely, the official diagnosis would be a drop in systolic blood pressure by 20 millimeters of mercury, or a drop in diastolic blood pressure by 10 millimeters of mercury when standing.
I'm curious, where are we getting those numbers from? Like, why is it 20 millimeters mercury and 10 millimeters mercury? Do those numbers have any real significance?
ultimately, what's important is what level of blood pressure change results in bad outcomes. So studies have looked at that. And the reason that we come up with a number like 20 millimeters of systolic pressure is because a drop of 20 or more millimeters pressure in systolic pressure is associated with bad outcomes, such as dizziness, falls, syncope.
That's Dr. Lou Lipsitz, our first consultant.
I am Lou Lipsitz, a geriatrician. I am currently a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and director of the Marcus Institute for Aging Research at Heber Senior Life. Syncope, falls, myocardial infarction, cognitive impairment. So that's why we use those parameters as sort of guidelines as to what might be significant.
Wow, I did not think about how orthostatic hypotension could be related to heart attacks, right? But now that I think about it, it makes sense that the coronaries fill during diastole and that diastolic blood pressure can get pretty low in orthostatic hypotension.
Yeah, it sure can. I mean, some people even consider orthostatic hypotension an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease. You know, I saw studies where it was associated with mortality and cognitive decline. But I mean, what's the takeaway here? You know, catching this disease is important. And the measurements, unfortunately, aren't always consistent. I mean, blood pressure measurements have actually been shown to be way more variable than we'd like to think, sometimes by 10 to 20 millimeters of mercury between measurements. And that gets even worse at higher blood pressures, which is why diagnosis is even trickier in patients with hypertension.
Wait a minute. Variations of like 10 to 20 millimeters per mercury? That's basically the difference between calling something orthostatic hypotension or not. Like literally, like those are the numbers in the definition, right? I think that definitely makes me feel more compelled to know then how exactly who should measure that blood pressure as accurately as possible. I think is making sure we have the right size cuff. And then the second, making sure that arm is supported and at the heart level.
Yeah, and I didn't know this, but actually a third thing is to have them lay flat for about 5 minutes to allow the blood pressure to stabilize. And most guidelines actually suggest checking the blood pressure at least twice to get a good baseline to compare our standing vital signs to. I mean, you know, if you can find time to do that in the hospital.
Wait, Nick, I have seen some technicians and nurses just compare blood pressures from sitting to standing. Is that right?
They're going to equilibrate when they're sitting, and you're not going to really know what happens under the maximal stress of supine to standing, which is what most people do when they faint.
So yeah, some advocate skipping sitting since blood pressure management's going from laying to standing actually have a higher correlation with falls and symptoms. And also, it's more realistic with how people get out of bed.
You have to check the blood pressure after the patient is laying down for at least 5 minutes. And then you ask a patient to stand up and you try to collect the blood pressure at 1, 3, 5, 10 minutes if the patient tolerates that. And you also have to measure the heart rate.
That's Dr. Cindy Shibao, our second consultant.
My name is Cindy Shibao, and I am a tenured professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University Medical Center and the associate director of the Autonomic Dysfunction Center.
Wait a minute. Let me just make sure I heard that correctly, Nick. They want us to check a blood pressure after standing at 1 minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and 10 minutes?
Yeah, I know. It's going to be tricky to get all these different data points in a busy hospital or clinic setting. But the point here is that if we only check the blood pressure 1 minute after standing, we may miss people who get symptoms at 2 minutes or 3 minutes. You know, it's not that uncommon.
Yeah, fair. I mean, I guess waiting longer will increase their sensitivity in patients who we have a higher index of suspicion for.
Yeah, patients who have early neurogenic disease actually tend to have a delay in their symptoms with standing. They may not get symptoms or orthostasis for 3 minutes after standing.
Oh, interesting. That's good to know. So this is all about like how to take a blood pressure in an ideal world where you have time and the patient is also patient with it. But I'm curious, does it matter when we check that orthostatic blood pressure? I mean, most of us just order AM orthostatic vital signs, right? But is that the right thing to do?
What you want to do is put them through the exact same situation in which they faint. Did it occur after a meal? Did it occur an hour after taking a medicine? Did it occur while standing up first thing in the morning when they're dehydrated? So first part of it, the answer is test them under the exact same circumstances in which the event, whatever it is, occurred.
So you can time your orthostatic vital signs around the triggers for the patient's symptoms. Like, were they eating lunch when they stood up and fell? Did they get lightheaded after walking around doing light chores? If you don't have those triggers, the early morning before medications is a good place to start.
We encourage not to just rely on one measurement, but try to do multiple measurements, particularly in the morning. right? And before the patient takes the medication, because that's the period of time where patients are very, very symptomatic, and it's more reliable because blood pressure in these patients, it changed dramatically throughout the day.
Okay, got it. So what did you do for your patient who had that severe urinary obstruction, now status post a catheter, has this post-obstructive diuresis that's now resolved, but is still lightheaded and you suspect has orthostatic hypotension?
So he didn't have any clear triggers. So we just tried measuring his orthostatic vital signs first thing in the morning. We got a good cuff. We measured his blood pressure twice while laying down. Luckily, we could find the time. And then we stood him right up. He could only stand for about 3 minutes before his symptoms set in. But if you compare his systolic blood pressure while laying down to the blood pressure when standing at 1 and 3 minutes, it went from 140 to 80 to 75 points. So it definitely dropped. And while that happened, his heart rate went from 70 to 85 beats per minute.
Wow, Nick, that systolic blood pressure dropped to 75? Ugh, not good. You know, you also reminded me about checking the heart rate. I mean, I remember somewhere along the way learning something about an increase in heart rate, like 30 or 20 can signal orthostatic hypotension.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I thought the same thing, but you know, I found out we really just use blood pressure to diagnose orthostatic hypotension.
Okay, so if we don't need heart rate for the diagnosis, why are we measuring it?
So what I found out is that we want to see if the heart rate is doing what we expect it to do. Basically, is it going up by enough? Because if it doesn't, it could mean that there's something wrong with the normal reflex arc to standing, meaning there could be some kind of neurogenic process driving the orthostatic hypotension.
We kind of tested this new index. So we take the blood pressure supine and standing at 1 minute, as well as the heart rate. So you calculate the difference in terms of, you know, how much the heart rate goes up from the supine to the upright posture at 1 minute and how low the blood pressure drops. And then, you know, you have this delta, the delta of the heart rate divided by the delta of the systolic blood pressure. And if this index is less than 0.5, then, you know, there is much, I mean, high likelihood that this is probably an autonomic neuropathy compared to, you know, blood volume depletion or these other factors that we just discussed.
And we will link to the ratio of the change in heart rate to the change in systolic blood pressure at 1 minute in our show notes. But another way to put it is that if the autonomic reflexes are intact, you know, that is if they're not being affected by neurogenic disease or a medication like a beta blocker, then for every 2 points that your systolic blood pressure drops when you stand, your heart rate should go up by one. So the change in heart rate over the change in systolic blood pressure should be at least 0.5 or higher.
Yeah. And so if you do see that change being greater than 0.5, then we're good. And autonomic neuropathy is less likely on the table.
Yep. If you see that the change in heart rate over the change in systolic blood pressure in standing is over 1.5, aka you're getting that heart rate response of at least 1 for every 2 point drop in systolic blood pressure, that's pretty suggestive of a non-neurogenic cause of orthostatic hypotension. In fact, it's 91% sensitive and 88% specific.
Nice. This is all great learning. Let's summarize our best practices we learned on orthostatic hypotension and making that diagnosis. I think, one, we want to make sure we have a good size cuff. If we can, try to have the patient lay supine for at least 5 minutes. Get a couple baseline reads and heart rate reads if we can. Have them stand right up and then document the blood pressure and heart rate and symptoms at 1 minute, 3 minutes, and then longer if we really want to increase the sensitivity. We want to make sure that it's not neurogenic, and we're going to look at the heart rate response and see if it's blunted or not. And then it could be helpful to do all of this around the same time the patient initially fell or was showing symptoms, or if not, just check it in the morning each day to standardize our readings. Okay, Nick, you said your patient's systolic blood pressure dropped from 140 to 80 at minute one. That's a change of 60 millimeters per mercury. And so you'd expect that heart rate to go up by at least 0.5 or half, so at least 30 beats per minute. But your patient's heart rate just went from 70 to 85. Nick, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I went back and I found that he did have some signs that he might have lost some fine touch and proprioception in the toes. So I was thinking that maybe his uncontrolled diabetes was causing peripheral autonomic dysfunction, and maybe that contributed to his urinary retention in the first place and now is contributing to his orthostatic hypotension.
Yeah, real quick, Nick, we throw around the term neurogenic causes often, but clear as kind, why don't we talk a little bit more about what exactly you put in that bucket versus other causes?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great question because the causes of orthostatic hypotension could really be its own big topic and episode. So let's keep things really simple and just think about two major buckets. The first bucket is going to be your neurogenic causes. Anything that impairs the normal baroreceptor reflex of sensing low blood pressure and then doubling norepinephrine levels in response. So this could be neurodegenerative diseases, things like Parkinson's disease or multisystems atrophy, or it could be neuropathies, things like diabetes or amyloidosis. The other bucket are the non-neurogenic causes. These are things that are going to impact venous return, like dehydration, or things that'll impact cardiac output, you know, things like heart disease or valvular disease. I did put in the show notes a deeper breakdown of causes for those interested, but just remember that a neurology referral can be helpful since some of these diseases can actually fall across both buckets.
Ah, interesting. I'm glad we're talking about neuro versus not neuro because I think they do have big implications in terms of treatment goals. And speaking of which, you know, I feel like most people put for treatment goal like free check AM orthostatic blood pressure and discharge when not orthostatic.
Yeah, I mean, I like making numbers look nice as much as the next internal medicine doctor, but that can be really hard for patients with orthostatic hypotension. And these patients aren't all the same. So what are our treatment goals and how does that depend on the specific patient we're treating? So I always thought that our treatment goal was going to be just making the standing blood pressure better. I mean, that makes sense, right? But this one circulation review article flipped my whole approach to treating orthostatic hypotension. It said that the goal is improvement in symptoms and functionality rather than correction of the orthostatic hypotension. And recommendations from other societies are in line with this.
Okay, so improving symptoms and functionality, that feels like a realistic goal, Nick, and probably a lot more patient-friendly, but it's also not very specific. How do we actually do this?
I mean, first off, yeah, we're not focusing on a particular number, but there are two somewhat nuanced caveats to that. The first is we do want to try keeping the standing blood pressure out of the danger zone.
But what exactly is then like a blood pressure target that's not a danger zone for patients? I mean, your patient's blood pressure dropped to like 75 milligrams per mercury at one point, right? Like it's pretty low.
Yeah, I agree. That is pretty low. But what's out of the danger zone can get a little bit gray. I mean, the brain adjusts its blood flow separate from the mean arterial pressure, aka the MAP. And it does that to keep the brain fed and happy at different blood pressures. But everyone's brain does this differently. So how low can a patient's MAP get before it affects the cerebral blood flow is hard to say. But our consultants did have some guidance here.
I will also try to just keep that systolic above 100 because that's really, I think, a critical and easily observed value that is sort of a critical point between perfusion and not.
So for many patients, aiming for a standing systolic blood pressure goal of at least 100 is a reasonable goal to make sure that the brain and the coronaries are perfusing and, you know, that they're able to do their daily activities. But the other caveat that we wanted to talk about here are patients with true severe neurogenic disease.
Now, if the patient has autonomic failure, they're always going to have orthostatic hypotension. I mean, you're not going to cure that because the problem with these patients is the cardiovascular autonomic reflexes are impaired.
And I don't care so much whether it's a 90 millimeter systolic or not, as long as they're able to do their activities. And because I know they're at risk of falling. I mean, I already know that. The question is, how long can I have them stand up?
Yeah, I've definitely had neurology consults have different thresholds for patients with severe neurogenic orthostatic hypotension. I think it's just a different group of patients where it gets even more gray and the number cutoffs that are dangerous for them is just a different ballgame.
Blood pressure goals can be so hard, especially in this population. So I want to take a step back towards our main goal of reducing or stopping any symptoms that affect functionality. You know, when I think about symptoms that come with orthostatic hypotension, I really like using this term orthostatic intolerance symptoms to remind myself to not just anchor on lightheadedness. That reminds me to think of any symptom that can come with standing.
Sometimes patients won't describe it necessarily as lightheadedness or dizziness. They might just say they feel weak or they feel a little unsteady. Or even if you kind of dive into it, like you watch their face, it looks like you're not feeling well right now. So there's quite a bit of me looking right at them when they're doing this to make sure I'm not seeing anything.
That's our third consultant, physical therapist Sharon Gorman.
So my name is Sharon Gorman. I am a licensed physical therapist. I've been a physical therapist for more than 20 years.
So you can get vision issues. You can get chest pain from poor coronary flow. One interesting symptom is called coat hanger pain that comes from decreased blood flow to the trapezius. Symptoms can also be subtle. Like, I wonder how many times I've written asymptomatic orthostatic hypotension as a diagnosis when my patient actually did have something, like maybe mild confusion when they stood up.
I think like the other flip side of all this, Nick, is like, what if we have a patient who doesn't have truly any warning symptoms, right? They just fell before they could respond.
But most people will be able to experience symptoms when they have a reduction in blood flow, but not everyone, particularly if they're older and have dementia or other conditions, may not be able to experience that.
Yeah, that's a super high-risk group. I mean, patients who have severe dysautonomia or dementia, where they may not be able to sense their orthostasis before falling, ugh, that really worries me.
Yeah, and I think like in some sense, like falling with no warning signs, people just assume like, oh, maybe it's cardiogenic and that's what they only worry about. But I think the other thing to keep in mind on the differential is maybe they have really bad orthostatic hypotension.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes when we think that the fall was caused by orthostatic hypotension, we're almost reassured, but it can still be really dangerous, especially in these patients with no warning.
Yeah, definitely. The other patient scenario to think about is a person we see in clinic who has actually positive orthostatic vitals, but they're doing fine. They have no symptoms. They haven't fell. They're tolerating it. This drop in blood pressure just fine. So what do we do about that?
Yeah, there are some patients who can physically tolerate a slightly lower blood pressure, you know, like their cerebral blood flow can adapt. But as much as I hate to find a problem with someone being fine, even if they're truly asymptomatic right now, studies show that asymptomatic orthostatic hypotension will often progress. In one study of older adults, the risk of unexplained falls doubled in these patients after 6 years.
Man, I just want to point out nuance here. You know, we said earlier that our treatment goal is symptoms and functionality, but at the same time, it seems like we just can't ignore that low blood pressure number when they stand. I think it seems like consistently throughout this episode, it's shown as it does carry a poor prognostic sign for bad outcomes to come later.
Definitely. To summarize the bigger point here, our treatment goal should be to focus on functionality and symptoms. And on the point of symptoms, we really want to investigate if there are any symptoms at all of orthostatic intolerance when the patient stands up. Signs of poor organ perfusion like chest pain, vision or mental status changes, or even neck pain.
Yeah, and while we don't want to focus on the number entirely in terms of our treatment goal, we do want to make sure that standing blood pressure is out of that danger zone. So for most people, it's going to be trying to getting them up to at least a systolic blood pressure of 90s to 100s when they stand. And of course, it's going to be challenging and the thresholds are so different and treatment goals are so different when it comes to severe dysautonomia. The neurogenic patient's neurology will just have some different individualized treatment goals.
I am so excited to have Echo Core 500 Digital Stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x, and then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, or on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently. And if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Here at Corium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we're talking about how the scrubs you wear
they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-up room looking way more put together after a night shift, and I knew right then and there they were wearing FIGS. FIGS Scrubs is made specifically for us doctors, residents, students, healthcare professionals who are putting in long hours and really need gear that can keep up and perform on our level. We have so much going on in any shift, right? Scrubs are the last thing we want to be thinking about, and that's why FIGS is great in that they're lightweight, stretchy, breathable. They have all the small touches that have made me a true convert. They're clean, they're modern, super functional, tons of pockets that I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to FIGS.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's FIGS.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first purchase. And with that, let's head back to the episode.
Okay, so let's try to apply some of these treatment goals to your patient. When you're treating this patient, what are you hoping to achieve?
Definitely. That's a great question. So when he stood up, he did report lightheadedness as well as feeling like his thoughts were kind of foggy. So I thought, okay, that's what I want to get better with treatment and hopefully get his systolic blood pressure to the 90s or 100s while we do it.
Yeah, man. I hope this doesn't mean that we're going to like put him on like three new medications.
Yeah, I know. I mean, medications are an important, important avenue, but I love that you're driving at the question of how we can intervene without medications right now. And this led me down a road with a lot of different pit stops. You know, I learned that different people need different kinds of fuel.
Oh, man, what a clunky analogy, but I do appreciate some levity.
So let's open the hood on how to prevent or treat orthostatic hypotension in the hospital without medications.
Okay, yes, I love thinking about non-pharmacological treatment. I don't know why, but it just makes me feel like such a good medicine doctor not using actual medicines.
I totally get that. That circulation paper recommended four big non-pharmacologic interventions for everyone with orthostatic hypotension, regardless of symptoms. And that starts with the oldest medicine known to man. Your body staying upright depends on your body continuing to move. Otherwise, gravity wins.
Interestingly, if you take the most healthy, fit astronaut and send them up to space for 24 hours, when they get back down on Earth, they can't stand. So it's not unusual that our older patients admitted to the hospital have orthostatic hypotension when they try to stand up after prolonged bed rest.
Yeah, so one study of elderly inpatients found that daily bed rest of at least 9 hours more than doubled morning orthostatic hypotension. When you rest, you retain less fluids, you aren't working your leg muscle pump, and those baroreceptors that help you stay vertical actually get less sensitive with time. And then, lo and behold, orthostatic hypotension develops.
A lot of patients think they can't get up because they have lines and tubes on them. There was actually a great study out of Australia with really healthy people who had no restrictions when they were in the hospital. And the number one reason they said they didn't get up was they had a Foley catheter, which is like the easiest thing to take with you and walk. But they thought because they had that and it hangs on the bed, I can't go anywhere. I'm just such the big person who pushes like everyone who can do whatever they can to encourage mobility. And even if that's you as the physician asking the patient when you come in the room, did you get up today? How often have you gotten up today? Why are you getting up? Oh, what's stopping you from getting up? How can we help you get up more? Even if you just ask those questions, that's giving the message to the patient that they need to move around.
Yeah, but one thing is that my patient already has orthostatic hypotension. I mean, I still want to encourage exercise, but I can't exactly tell my patient who almost passes out when they stand up to go walk laps around the unit. I mean, I was honestly kind of worrying that maybe it's too late to promote mobility. But, you know, our experts assured me that we can still get these patients moving, even if that doesn't mean standing.
If I have somebody who I know has a really big problem with orthostasis, I may put the head of the bed up, let them start adjusting to that, do some lower extremity exercises in bed first to try and boost that venous return, get those muscle pumps helping.
So I thought this was super interesting. I talked to Sharon a bit more, and she said that for these in-bed exercises, she recommends patients do at least 5 to 10 reps in bed, like 2 to 3 times a day, especially as a warm-up to get blood moving before they get up and move.
And you might want to start with supine bicycle exercises, which are great because you're not standing upright, but you're supine, you know, semi-supine, and you're using your leg muscles. There was a nice study a number of years ago that showed that people with severe orthostatic hypotension could lie in bed and take these TheraBands, you know, these stretchy rubber bands, and put them around their feet and extend their feet, 10 on one side, 10 on the other side, and then stand up. And they actually ameliorated much of the orthostatic hypotension and enabled them to do their activities that they needed to do in the morning.
Wow. Can we get our patients TheraBands? This sounds so cool. You know, Nick, I have to say, I do love giving my patients homework. I do love telling them, like, I want you to do knee bends and arm raises every hour. And I'm sure like our physical therapy colleagues have even better exercises, like some of the ones they just mentioned, like the semi-supine bicycle movements. Even like seated liftoffs can be helpful in terms of getting muscle pumping without having them actually stand.
Okay, so the first non-pharmacologic treatment is to get patients moving. The second is that you want to look for anything that's clearly treatable or reversible that contributes to the orthostatic hypotension. Think here about dehydration to start. I mean, many patients have poor appetite at baseline as they get older. Then in the hospital, they face long emergency room stays without food or fluids, NPO status, restrictive diet, aggressive diuresis. I mean, we are kind of pros at dehydration.
Yeah, and I think we've already touched on some causes. You know, we thought about if dehydration is contributing, if there's some autonomic dysfunction at play. I think the one we've left out is a really big offender, which is medications.
Yeah, what caught my eye on my patient's medication list was his isosorbide mononitrate and his lisinopril.
So one of the things that we usually do is we look at what medication these patients are taking. Because sometimes, you know, you can find hidden agents like, for example, tizanidine is a big problem in the South. There is an overuse of that medication. People don't know that it's similar to clonidine, for example, right? So you have to stop that medication. When we look at the type of medication that really produce a lot of problems with orthostatic hypotension, for example, beta blockers, one of the culprit diuretics, that's another culprit, you know, vasodilators like nifedipine, for example, that can cause orthostatic hypotension. So what we ask is don't stop everything. Just, you know, stop the medications that has been associated with orthostatic hypotension.
So focus on holding or reducing high-risk medications. Being dehydrated is a risk for falls, so be careful with loop diuretics. And think about anything that will block the adrenergic response to standing. Things like beta blockers, alpha blockers like doxazosin or tamsulosin, or even tricyclic antidepressants, or alpha-2 agonists like tizanidine or clonidine. Finally, if your blood vessels dilate as you stand up, you're going to be at higher risk for falls. So primary vasodilators like nitrates can also be high risk.
Nice, nice. Let me just reiterate that in a way my brain can understand. So maybe I'll just make it like alphabetical to just chunk it out a little bit more. So big offenders, high-risk meds are going to be A, alpha blockers like tamsulosin, alpha-2 agonists like clonidine or tizanidine, beta blockers, nitrates that vasodilate, and then tricyclic antidepressants. You also said that the ACE inhibitor caught your eye, but that one's not on the high-risk category. So maybe I'm guessing the ACE and ARBs are lower risk?
Yeah, they're relatively lower risk. I mean, you may still need to hold them if patients remain orthostatic on them, but it may not need to be your first move. Check the show notes for a graphic on the relative risk of different antihypertensive medications on causing orthostatic hypotension. But basically, to that effect, we held the patient's isosorbide mononitrate, but continued his lisinopril.
Great. I think here's the part where I get stuck, Nick. Is a third bucket of non-pharm things to try, which is compression stockings. I think I've ordered compression stockings so many times, abdominal binders so many times, and I don't know if it's really doing anything. And like more so, like I'm like, is this the right fit for my patient?
Okay, so when we start talking about compression, things are going to get a lot more gray. For instance, some clinicians say that you need to compress the entire leg and the abdomen to squeeze blood all the way back to the heart.
Like a tube of toothpaste?
Like a tube of toothpaste. But talking to Dr. Shibao, she actually made a good case that abdominal binders could be effective on their own.
So what we did is we took a lot of graduate students. We put them electrodes all over the body, and then we tilt them. And then we tried to estimate where the fluid goes when you are tilted up. The majority of the fluid sequestrates in the abdominal area, not in the thighs, not in the calf, and definitely not in the feet. It goes really to the abdominal area. We have shown that just using an abdominal binder is as potent as using midodrine. When we did a comparison between the midodrine and the inflatable abdominal binder,
Wow, what a great headliner. Abdominal binders are as good as midodrine in these like healthy graduate students. I love this because we know fluid sequesters in the abdomen. And so when you stand up, this is where the money is, right? And I love when the science pans out and abdominal binder is as potent as midodrine.
So what we usually do is, you know, we encourage our patients to wear any of the commercial abdominal binder, I mean, or the lumbar support, and see if with that they are able to do to have some symptomatic improvement and also adhere to the therapy. And so far, I mean, for us, I mean, it's been very useful because patients like the fact that they are able to, you know, put it on, put it out, or take it out fast.
I love that the focus here is super practical, right? Because abdominal binders are just easier for a patient to use on their own. And most of our patients are on their own at home, right? Because I feel kind of guilty when we're treating a patient with compression stockings and they need all this help in the hospital with nursing. It's a whole production to get these compression stockings on. And so like, how are they going to really manage this at home?
Yeah, but then again, just because abdominal binders can be effective, don't totally discount leg compression. Remember, we said it's gray. Our older patients with venous pooling in their legs aren't the healthy graduate students in Dr. Chabot's study that benefited so much from abdominal binders.
How do we give helpful instructions to our older patients who might need leg compression too?
If we use compression stockings, bunching them up below the knee actually prevents venous return rather than promotes venous return. And I've always... It's funny, as a younger attending, I would always say, they've got to be thigh high because obviously, you know, we don't want to bunch them up below the knee, but I don't know if nobody can get the thigh high ones on. Absolutely. So I have sort of modified my view and said, at least if you can get them up to the knee and try not to bunch them up underneath, that's probably the best.
Okay, this is great advice, but I really didn't know what specifically I'd be asking my patients to go and get. So I found out that actually most compression stockings actually list how much pressure they apply on the packaging. Dr. Lipset suggested looking for ones that provide at least 20 to 30 milligrams of mercury of pressure. And if those are too hard to get on, you can also try ones that give at least 15 to 20 milligrams of mercury of pressure. So yeah, I mean, this is obviously super situational. In our case, we didn't have fitted thigh-high compression stockings for my patient, and the ones that we did give him just kept bunching up around the knee, kind of like Dr. Lipset said, you know, we were worried about blocking venous return, so we just stopped using the compression stockings altogether.
Mm-hmm. So I guess for some people, compression stockings can work, and some, like your patient, it might not.
So for the last thing in the non-pharmacologic toolkit, I want to look at behavioral changes that patients can make. And to start, I want to talk about something that really surprised me, and that's that the way patients drink their water can actually help to treat orthostatic hypotension.
The other thing is drinking water as fast as you can. So a lot of these patients, when they drink 16 ounces of water as fast as they can, the blood pressure increases in about 30 minutes. And so it's a very good rescue measure to increase the blood pressure when, you know, a patient doesn't have access to their medication or they're in a place where they cannot sit down or lay down, right? Because they have symptoms.
Yeah, this is like really interesting. Rapidly drinking about one water bottle's worth of cool water in 3 to 4 minutes is like unexpectedly effective. I mean, get this. In a study of older patients, it increased standing systolic blood pressure by an average of 12 millimeters of mercury. Another study of those with dysautonomia showed it increased norepinephrine levels in patients with neurogenic disease, similar to 2 to 3 cups of coffee.
Wait, chugging water did this?
Yeah, I know. The thought is that this works because water's hypotonic, so don't add anything. But having patients drink this bolus of water in the morning or before exercise can actually really help.
What a clutch hack, if there was a medicine hack. I think the other behavioral thing they've seen people recommend is, like, you know, stay hydrated, not just, you know, with that morning chug of cold water, but like throughout the day. I think people have also been told to eat salt. I think, Nick, you were saying you had an attending who used to tell people to like have soy sauce in the morning.
Right. I mean, for patients that aren't at risk for volume overload, you know, recommending at least 2 liters per day of fluids can help. So that's definitely something to keep in mind. You know, I found out that you need like 5 to 10 grams of sodium per day to really affect your orthostatic blood pressure.
Yeah, definitely. With salt, you know, we are all constantly worried about the edema, the hypertension. I think it has to be right for that patient.
I also want to move on to think about things we can recommend that our patients avoid, you know, triggers for orthostatic hypotension.
So, of course, triggers are a big important part of management, right? We ask them not to take hot showers, not to take a hot bath because that produces vasodilation. We ask them try to limit the amount of caffeine because that produces diuresis and volume depletion. We ask them to wear abdominal binders that, you know, compress the splanchnic circulation to prevent the significant drop in blood pressure after you trap blood in the splanchnic, once again, blood vessels. And we ask the patient if eating, particularly large meal rich in carbs, trigger a worsening of their symptoms because some of these patients have postprandial hypotension.
So changing a patient to more smaller meals to lower those big carbohydrate boluses can actually really help. Also, tell them to try to avoid heat because remember, sweating is a sympathetic activity and patients with autonomic dysfunction may not be able to do that to cool themselves off.
Great. So why don't we summarize all the things in the non-pharmacological buckets that we talked about? First is really promoting exercise, mobility, get those muscles pumping. Second is really to assess any treatable causes for orthostatic hypotension, like stopping any of those high-risk medications. And if orthostatic hypotension persists despite all of this, we can consider compression like abdominal binders or thigh-high compression stockings. That don't bunch up behind the knee. And then in terms of behavioral changes, we learned about a really cool trick about having patients chug cold water first thing in the morning as fast as possible. And that could help with some orthostatic hypotension and avoid triggers like heat or high carb meals. All right. Stay tuned for our next episode where we're going to learn more about what happened to Nick's patients. You know, did these non-pharmacological interventions help? And if so, by how much? And did he have to reach for some medications? And if so, what was the right approach?
That's a wrap for today. You know, as much as we love going through this case, we also love going through other cases. So if you have one that you want to bring to us, please email us at hello@coreimpodcast.com. And if you found this episode helpful, please share with your team and colleagues and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
Thank you to our reviewers, Dr. Adam Strauss and Dr. Jason Yoon. And as always, opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you. Take care.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.